Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and here's one market force that's putting the squeeze on American families.
The U.S. as a whole is paying an extra $1.2 billion a day. That translates to about $4 per person per day.
That's analyst Severin Bornstein with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. So what's causing each of us to shell out an average of 1,500 extra bucks this year? Is it A, the weak dollar? We import so much stuff from Europe, Canada, and Asia that we're getting crushed by the exchange rate. Or are we talking B, drought-like conditions throughout the U.S.? It ain't cheap keeping our lawns green, our pools filled, and our cars washed. Or maybe it's C, the record high price of oil. It factors into everything we buy, from transportation to packaging. The answer is coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. They call it black gold, that stuff that oozes out of the ground and into our gas tanks. It's incredibly expensive these days, and that's affecting more than the usual suspects. Oh, and it's not just black gold that's costing a fortune. The yellow stuff does, too. I'm Tessa Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
If it feels like the dollars are fleeing your wallet faster than ever these days, it is not your imagination. This week, we learned that food and energy prices pushed inflation up by more than 4% last year. That's the biggest jump since 1990. A good chunk of the blame goes to high oil prices. This month, they hit 100 bucks a barrel for the first time. And that means much more than just expensive gasoline at the pump. We asked Marketplace's Lisa Napoli to take a look at how our consumer pipeline is being squeezed in ways you might not realize.
This package of healthy veggie nuggets contains nothing but garbanzos, lentils, sunflower seeds, lemon juice, not a trace of oil. Unless you factor in just about everything that got all those ingredients to where this food was made and packaged to me, so I could eat it for lunch.
We're all connected in every way, and sadly, we are all connected to petroleum products.
That's Leslie Starris. For 27 years, her company's been making healthy packaged foods, stuff like tempeh burgers and veggie wraps and hummus. And lately, to make all that food is costing her a lot more than it used to. She's showing me around her warehouse in Sun Valley, California.
Petroleum-based products are in anything that has to do with packaging, which is what you're seeing here, boxes and boxes and boxes of packaging. From the paper to the plastic containers that we use to put our product into, they've risen at least 20 to 25%.
Then there are the raw ingredients, the vegetables and beans, which are trucked in from all over the country.
The cost of them per pound to buy has definitely gone up at least 20%. Because of the same thing. The farmer has to pay more to process them.
It also costs more money to run the machine Starris uses in her facility. For as long as she could, she's held steady on her prices to keep competitive. But at the end of last year, she finally had to raise them. She's not the only one. Bigger food suppliers like General Mills and Pillsbury have increased what they charge, too. In case you haven't been paying attention at the grocery store, food prices are skyrocketing faster than any time in the past 17 years.
We really have become such a fossil fuel society that we don't realize all of the things that we use every day that are really based on a petroleum platform.
Fred Kirschman is an agriculture professor at Iowa State University. He's also an organic farmer. He says oil became essential to the food production process for a reason. It used to be cheap.
It was understandable because oil was so seductive. Our industrial food system has made it so easy to transport whole foods from around the world and get them to us any time of year at a very affordable cost. It seemed like the whole future, that cheap energy would always be available.
Now that it's not, everyone's scrambling for ways to cut back or reconfigure, and that's causing different problems. The price of flour has risen nearly 40% over the last few years because farmers aren't growing as much wheat. That's in part because they're now planting corn to fuel the demand for ethanol. Now, higher oil prices are taking their toll on much more than food. Late last year, Dow Chemical said it's shutting one of its plastic plants because of rising material costs. You've probably noticed fuel surcharges being slapped on everything from taxi rides to plane tickets to anything you get delivered.
An increase in oil prices ends up permeating the entire retail economy.
Severin Bornstein is an oil industry expert at the University of California, Berkeley.
When the price is, say, $60 higher than we thought it was going to be, when it's up in the 90s instead of down in the 30s, that means that the U.S. as a whole is paying an extra $1.2 billion a day for products. $1.2 billion a day translates to about $4 per person per day.
Almost $1,500 a year more we're spending. If you're scoring at home, that's $6,000 for a family of four. As a sympathetic employer, Leslie Starris feels the pain.
Your employees are then paying more for everything, just like everyone else, but they're hardly making it because you can't really give them the raise they deserve.
And it all traces back to the higher price of oil. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
The stock markets are off to a terrible start this year. For some investors, it's so bad, they're turning their attention elsewhere. Maybe you can hear them right now.
I love gold!
Yes, lots of investors apparently love gold. The price for 1 ounce of the shiny stuff topped $900 this week, up from just $600 a year ago. Sounds like a case of gold fever. And here to sift through it all is Peter Morici. He's an economics professor at the University of Maryland. Hi, Peter. Thanks for coming in.
It's nice to be with you.
You know, we hear at times of economic uncertainty about the so-called flight to safety, the flight to gold. Is that what we're seeing right now?
Absolutely. There's a great deal of uncertainty about the dollar. We have too many dollars abroad because of our large trade deficits. And as you know, the New York banks are in a lot of trouble. And that is causing a great deal of uncertainty. We've got gold over $900 an ounce, which is pretty high. It's not the all-time high in inflation-adjusted terms. We'd have to get up over $2,100 an ounce to match what we had in 1980.
What actual practical good does it do an investor to hold gold? Because you're not actually holding, you know, a cube of bullion. Is it something that does protect you in any way from a downturn in the economy?
Depends on who you are and where you are. If you're in a country that is not very stable and you have great concerns about the value of its currency or the stability of the government, then holding gold or holding dollars is very useful. For investors in the United States, I find this gold frenzy somewhat troubling. I think they're betting wrong. Over time, the dollar has proven to be a very stable source of value. You can hedge it against inflation with inflation-adjusted bonds issued by the Treasury Department. We've never reneged on our government debt.
So at this point, is gold something that an average investor would want to be holding in their portfolio?
I don't think this is a good time to buy gold. Gold has been bid all the way up. It may go a little bit higher, but I would suggest the best place for an average investor to buy today would be the U.S. stock market. The upside potential in stocks is much greater than the upside potential in gold. At the end of the day, if you want to do something with your gold, you have to convert it into dollars. If you want to do something with your stocks, you have to do the same. A year from now, the stocks you buy today will likely yield a better return than the gold you buy today.
Gold isn't the only metal that has been doing quite well. I know copper has hit some highs, even silver. Are metals something that people should research, take an interest in?
Well, industrial metals have great utility, and they're in much demand because of the growth in China. Much is going on in India as well. They're demanding everything from cement to lumber to steel, to copper, so building materials, and a lot of metals are building materials, are in great demand. I don't know that I would bet that way because investors have already bid up the prices of those stocks relative to other stocks. Certainly, they will rise in value with the general stock market. For the typical investor, the school teacher listening to Marketplace or the government employee or the college professor, buying the S&P 500, putting your money in a broad, diversified investment such as the TIAA-CREF index is really the way to go.
Peter Morici teaches economics at the University of Maryland School of Business. Thank you so much.
You're quite welcome. It's been a real pleasure.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is here now for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story. And Chris, this week the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on a case that's been hailed as really one of the most significant for investors and businesses in years, if not decades.
Oh, there's been a lot of interest in this case. And here's what was at stake. When a publicly traded company like Enron lies about its finances, can third-party businesses be sued if they knew about the fraud? A couple of lower courts said, no, you can't sue their accountants, investment bankers, and other vendors. Mm-hmm. And the Supreme Court agreed.
As I understand it, that's even if these outside companies were basically aiding and abetting the fraud.
That's right. There's this very subtle, nuanced difference between being the primary perpetrator of the fraud and aiding and abetting. And, you know, to me, I'm not a lawyer, but this comes awfully close to saying it's okay for accountants and investment bankers and the like to wink, wink and nod, nod at their client's shady dealings. Here's a straight story. This ruling is a setback for shareholder rights in an era of all too common corporate fraud from Enron to this current subprime loan mess. It's one in a series of rulings by the Supremes that seems to be aimed at blocking shareholder lawsuits.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the ramifications of this particular case. This case actually involved a cable company, not Enron, but it has a potential real implication on companies that helped Enron cook the books, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the relation to the Enron thing is that there's a $40 billion lawsuit involving the investment bankers and the lawyers in Enron. And so obviously this has big implications for that lawsuit. And it's a big win for the Chamber of Commerce and the New York Stock Exchange, Wall Street, and the accountants.
This seems to be just the latest, as you mentioned, in a series of rulings, both from the court system as well as from the regulatory system that doesn't seem to favor investors, the regular guy shareholder anymore. You know, you had the SEC last fall basically saying that investors couldn't have any say in who was going to go on the board of directors of a company. Have we completely forgotten about what happened earlier in the decade with Enron and WorldCom and Adelphia and all those companies that did wrong to shareholders?
I think it's a major backlash against the individual shareholder, against shareholder rights. This Supreme Court in recent years has made it very clear that they're on a campaign against what they call nuisance lawsuits. And they consider a lot of these privately bought shareholder lawsuits as a nuisance. And if you look at Justice Stevens' comments, where he was in the minority voting against this ruling, you know, he said we're coming awfully close to granting immunity to a lot of these outside vendors. And I think one of the things that we've been learning out of all this experience is that the Federal Reserve was asleep when it came to protecting consumers and the home mortgage mess. The Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, it's owned by the banking industry. The Securities and Exchange Commission has been weakened. And so what we need to fight for is actually a regulator that is willing to regulate the industry and is willing to defend the rights of the individual shareholder, which I would like to remind everybody is the owner of the company.
All right. The Straight Story from our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hey, thanks, Chris, as always.
Thanks a lot.
Want to own a great piece of property in an expensive city? Gather together with friends and pool your resources, but be prepared for the occasional cat fight.
Pets are a big issue with people. More people fight about pets than money. So we try to be very specific about the agreements on pets.
And what to do when your bank is gobbled up in a merger. That's ahead on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tessa Viglund. We've been calling it a buyer's housing market for several months now. You'd think with all the foreclosures and price markdowns that it'd be easier to find a nice house for a reasonable price. But in a lot of cities, it's still incredibly expensive to buy a place. So people are teaming up to buy multifamily buildings. In San Francisco, the arrangement is known as tenancy in common. It's been around for almost two decades, but Rachel Dornhelm tells us it's more trendy than ever these days.
The big lesson in today's housing market? Mortgages can be risky. So imagine going in on a $1 million home loan with three strangers.
By the end of the meeting, let's also get settled up because I know everybody has laid out money for expenses. And it'd be good.
That's Carla McKay at the first house meeting for her new tenancy in common. She's talking about paying for doormats and home insurance. She's now the co-owner of this three-unit building in San Francisco's hip Mission District. The other owners include a couple who were McKay's old neighbors and Matt Raymond, found through a real estate agent.
We met that first time, and I think it was pretty obvious, yeah, we're totally in line with how we want the place and our expectations, and we got along fine. No one seemed too weird.
Over wine and cheese, the four professionals decide how to split the cost of the garbage bill by person, the cost of the locksmith by unit, and the cost of insurance by the percentage of the building they own. Sound complicated? It can be, but it's worth it for those like Carla, who otherwise couldn't get into the market.
I just walked in here, I was like, wow, okay, this is nice, and I can afford it because it's a TIC, it's not a condo.
Carla, a vice president at the California Bankers Association, bought the whole building with her partners for almost $2 million. The seller was happy because he got more than if he'd just sold it as a rental property. Carla's group was happy because they paid up to $400,000 less than if they'd bought individual condos. Where's the downside?
Resales.
And that's housing lawyer Lisa Paul. She says it can sometimes be difficult for co-owners to get out of a shared mortgage. Then there are your housing partners.
You have to get along with people, or try. You know, you have to understand you're sort of cohabitating.
This is where tenant in common agreements come in. Plenty of people around the country co-own property. They just don't have the legal agreement that was popularized by Lisa's firm in San Francisco. Without it, co-owners legally have to split things evenly. But the inch-thick document tries to head off disputes. It spells out rules about percentages owned, parking, noise, and the number one co-housing killer.
Pets are a big issue with people. More people fight about pets than money. So we try to be very specific about the agreements and pets.
Some states have laws that make these tenant in common agreements difficult, if not impossible, in order to protect existing renters. And even though San Francisco allows them, the city imposes lots of restrictions. Like in some cases, if you buy a building, you have to occupy it for a number of years before you rent it. But Lisa says the reach of these more formalized co-ownership agreements is growing.
We've done them up and down the coast in California. You know, obviously San Francisco and the peninsula, Santa Barbara, Los Angeles, San Diego. I had a client recently in Chicago, so it's spreading.
Lisa advises people interested in a shared mortgage to only deal with others willing to reveal their financials. She says you can't rely on the bank verifying your partner's creditworthiness. If a default wasn't your fault, the bank still gets the building. In San Francisco, I'm Rachel Dornhelm for Marketplace Money.
Sincere apologies. Bring us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, mortgage insurance deduction. That's a new tax refund for homeowners' insurance payments, not to protect against floods. It's because they couldn't put 20% down, so they had to buy private mortgage insurance. Homeowners who earn less than $100,000 can write off the entire amount, and those that make $9,000 more can write off part of it. Okay, Congress! Except, maybe they forgot about those who earn more than $109,000. They're not eligible. In that case, maybe Congress should say something else. Sorry!
Customers of Countrywide Financial are probably scratching their heads these days, wondering what happens now that Bank of America is buying out the troubled mortgage lender. No doubt there have been some sighs of relief. A buyout is always better than a bankruptcy, which was rumored for months at Countrywide. But what about the practical stuff? What changes? Jane DeRista is with the research group Financial Markets Center. And Jane, what's normal in these situations?
For the consumer, you know, usually it is absolutely no change. I mean, you might get a change of name or checkbook, but in good times, that's about as far as it goes. These are not good times, and therefore, consumer beware. Read the fine print when they change your credit card. Be certain you know what you're signing on to when you take a loan. I mean, a lot of the people who had mortgages out from Countrywide did not know some of the details of those loans. I mean, we've just passed a very terrible period for consumers because unless you were really with your magnifying glass, bad things could have happened to you.
Mm-hmm. What about your mortgage interest rate, the rate you're getting on a CD, the fees on a bank account? Would those potentially change?
Yes, all of those can change. Very often in the agreements that you're sent on credit cards, for example, they will tell you that they can change the interest rate without notice or the terms without notice.
I remember back in the mid-90s, there were a whole lot of bank takeovers. And I wonder if there was any research done on whether consumers profit when a smaller bank is taken over by a bigger one.
Well, they may profit in terms of convenience. The larger bank may have more branches and more ATMs and things of this sort. My concern at this point is concentration. It makes it a lot easier for a bank to set terms that are really at variance with the needs of a community when they are the only large or dominant institution in an area. At the moment, I'm very concerned about small businesses. Many owners of small businesses were persuaded to take out larger amounts of mortgage or equity loans on their residences rather than apply for small business loans. It's a lot easier for the banking institution to sell on a mortgage and get it off its books, whereas it has to keep the small business loan on its books. We've seen the impact of all these foreclosures on communities. My concern is that's only the first step. The second one will be the effect on small businesses and communities.
But in general, for the time being, customers of Countrywide won't see a huge difference, and there aren't necessarily risks that will go along for them of this takeover.
I think that's right. The average depositor in Countrywide is going to be okay for a time being. If they already have a mortgage out there, there's not going to be a problem if they know the terms. They won't be able to do home equity loans. They won't be able to go back and refinance their mortgages for quite a while.
Jane DeRista is an economic analyst with Financial Markets Center, and she joined us from Connecticut. Thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement and by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
All right, it is that time in the show where we get personal and we answer all those pesky money questions that you, the listener, have. We also call it Stump the Farrell. Of course, our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is never stumped, are you, Chris?
Oh, yeah, I think you got me a few times, but pesky? I don't know about pesky.
All right, let's go ahead and hit the phones. Our first call is from Aaron in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, how are you?
We're good. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
All right. So what do you do there in Indianapolis?
I'm a radiographer.
A radiographer. Is that medicine, I assume?
Yeah, I take x-rays. And I'm in school to get my degree to do MRIs and CTs.
Oh, so you're in grad school?
Yes. I'm trying to get my master's in health sciences. That's going to be my focus.
Well, what's your question for Chris today? Sounds like you've got everything handled.
Oh, gosh, no.
No. Oh, okay.
Well, my life, as far as financially, has a lot of ups and downs through my life. Well, I'm 40 years old, and when I was in my 20s and 30s, at times when I had really good jobs, I did really well on paying my bills. And then when I didn't have really good jobs and I was in school, I didn't do very well on paying my bills if I paid them. Some of my bills I have gone to court because they want their money, which I don't blame them. I want mine too. So I have a couple of judgments against me for these credit card bills.
Credit card debt. All right.
Yeah. And my question is, now that I have graduated and able to get those bills taken care of, should I call those collection agencies and say, I won't pay this amount so I can clear it off, even though I know it'll be considered a charge-off?
What kind of money are we talking about here?
One is almost $3,000, and then the other one is $5,400.
Do you actually want to eventually pay off the entire sum?
Well, I don't agree with the entire sum because of all the interest that's accrued. I agree with the amount that I was charged against when we went to court. That's why I was wondering if it was okay to make that phone call and see if they would just take the original amount, because I could have that in a month.
And that is perfectly okay to do. Go ahead and make that phone call. But if you're going to actually negotiate a deal, you need to get everything in writing, because people can say whatever they want over the phone. They don't have to follow through.
Chris, if she gets an agreement with the collection company to take a lesser amount than what they say she owes, isn't that called a charge-off? And then how does that reflect on her credit score?
It will have an impact on her credit score. Now, we don't have the impact that we used to have in the old days, where it could be fairly dramatic. But again, it still will have it will be a negative item on your file. But it's not that big. And frankly, I think that there's this point for everybody where they have to sort of make a certain type of decision. You know, do they want to pay off this debt or not? I tend to believe people should pay off their debts, even if it does have an impact on their credit score. And that is an approach that people take.
All right. So, Aaron, do you think you'll be making that phone call?
Oh, definitely. It's my debt and I want to pay it.
All right. Well, let us know how it went.
Okay.
Well, thanks so much for the call.
No problem.
Well, if you've made some money mistakes and you're trying to redeem yourself, let us help. Do visit our website. We're at marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. All right, Chris, let's reach into the email bag. And Wen wrote in from Boston, Massachusetts. She is a 24-year-old law student, and she's been inspired by the show. Yay. To consider switching her Roth IRA mutual fund to a socially responsible index fund like the Domini Fund. And this is a question we get a lot from folks regarding socially responsible mutual funds. She did some research to compare her current fund to the Domini Fund, and she found that her current fund is a better performer on the earnings chart, but it also has higher expense ratios and higher fees. Boo.
Mm.
So her question really is there a tool out there that will allow her to do some sort of bottom line comparison between the funds?
Tessa, I have two websites that she can visit. Now, what we can compare and come up with concrete numbers are fees, the impact of fees over time. Mm-hmm. What the return is going to be. You know, you and I could have a good conversation thinking, well, I think this is the right part of the market
right.
to be in or long term. But we have no idea.
No, it's up to the market.
It's up to the market. But we can compare those fees. Now, the first one is a new name. We used to call it the NASD. Now it's FINRA, right?
Right. And in full disclosure, I should say that they are an underwriter of this program.
Well, they have the Mutual Fund Expense Analyzer. And what's nice about this is you can compare the expenses, fees of up to three funds. You can also go to the Securities and Exchange Commission website, sec.gov. And at that website, they have a mutual fund cost comparison calculator. You can see the impact of fees. I think it's great. This is a great question. And it's important for people to realize that these tools do exist to compare fees. And just as returns compound over time, we talk about that compounding effect, fees compound over time, too.
All right. Well, if you need a question answered, please do give us a call. Our phone number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. And now we are answering your questions every weekday online at marketplace.org. Just click on the Getting Personal link. And stay tuned for more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. How many of you knew exactly what you wanted to do when you graduated from college? Not everybody does. Sean Aiken didn't have a clue, so he decided to go with the buffet plan. Since last February, he's been sampling different careers 1 week at a time. We caught up with him at an investment management firm in Fort Lauderdale.
Dow Jones is down 140. Look at Zoomies. I told you Zoomies
was a big
play. It's down 60 cents.
I think this is going to come down again. I think it's going to hit again.
Why?
Before it
Tell
goes
me
up.
Before you think. Tell me why.
My name is Sean Aiken. I graduated with a business administration degree, and it was time to get a real job and a career, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. And so I came up with the idea to go out there and try a whole bunch of different ones.
That is
4160. So if we draw it past that 460, it's probably going to come down to 4090.
Exactly. Because you keep redrawing.
This is fun. When I first told my dad about the idea, he said, "Are you kidding me? Like, just get a real job." I don't know, he has to support it, I guess, because my last year in college, we're sitting around the dinner room table and everybody's throwing out ideas of, you know, what should Sean do with his life? You know, everybody was putting in their 2 cents, and then my dad stepped into the conversation and he said, "Sean, you know, it doesn't matter what you do, whatever it is, just make sure it's something you're passionate about." And so that was something that really stuck with me. People hear about the project through media or through friends, and they visit the website, and all the information is there on how to offer me jobs. Any wages that the company is willing to pay me for them a week, they make a direct donation to the One campaign, and so I'm not actually paid. It's as if I'm volunteering my time. Last week I was working with Truly Nolan Pest Control as an exterminator killing termites. Now I'm trading stocks. And next week I'll be a baker in Brooklyn. And, you know, I think that's the great thing about the project is that just doing something completely different week after week, you know, always out of my comfort zone, putting myself in these unfamiliar situations, I think that's when you learn and grow the most about yourself. My favorite job so far is I was working with a brewmaster in a microbrewery, and that was just a really fun environment to be part of, really great people. Also, a yoga instructor, that week stands out in my mind, you know, not having stood foot in a studio, yoga studio before that day, and then to find out that I'd be teaching classes on the Friday. You know, I was scared and I was terrified, and I was like, I can't do this. And in my mind, I was making up all these excuses as why I couldn't do it. And then I committed to the process, and then there I was Friday standing up before these classes and actually teaching yoga. And so kind of see that growth throughout the week was really kind of a nice personal achievement, I guess. I've only refused one job, and that was to be a news anchor with the Naked News Daily. Basically, it's a totally legit news service, but as they're actually giving the news, they strip. And so by the end of the newscast, you're completely naked. And I didn't think my mom would appreciate that, and so I kindly refused. My least favorite job so far, I was picking cattails for this company who goes out into the wild and picks wild products and sells them to high-end restaurants. 12-hour days out in the swamp and the scorching heat and all these bugs. You know, but the great thing was that each job only lasts a week and you can do anything for a week. My advice, I think, to people in the same situation as me, you know, coming out of college and not too sure what they want to do with their lives, first, learn about yourself and what you're going to need in a career to be happy. And don't settle. Don't settle.
To learn more about Sean Aiken's one-week job project, visit our website at marketplace.org. A Day in the Work Life was reported by Heidi Pickman. Coming up on the program, China's been the talk of the investing world for a couple of years now. We'll talk to an economist who knows how to ride the dragon, if you can stomach it.
I know people who literally get sick if something they've bought in their portfolio fluctuates too much.
And a financial tutor gets his own lesson from Chris. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Think the housing situation is bad here? Be thankful you don't live in China. Home prices in that country's 70 biggest cities were up more than 10% in December compared to a year earlier. Officials there worry that soaring prices could cause a debt crisis. Sound familiar? But even with all those problems, many investors still see China as a key to a profitable portfolio. Last month, we aired an interview with economist Burton Malkiel about his new book, From Wall Street to the Great Wall. We talked about why China's investment climate and stock exchanges are a little different from ours. Today, we've asked him to talk about the how. So, Professor, if you're interested in investing in China, what's the best way to do it?
One of the main strategies that is recommended in the book is, first of all, that you don't put all of your money in direct investments in Chinese stocks, but that one would use an indirect approach as well.
So that would be taking advantage of, for example, the run-up in steel prices because of the building boom there, or the run-up in energy.
That would be exactly one example. This would be a lower-risk indirect way of accessing the Chinese market. In addition, there are many companies where the growth depends almost entirely on China. Let me give you a couple of examples. We have a company in the United States called Yum Brands. Yum Brands is the parent of Kentucky Fried Chicken, of Pizza Hut, of Taco Bell. And Yum Brands is not doing terribly well in the United States, yet Yum Brands is growing at 20% a year. Why? Because of China.
So we've exported our fast food obsession.
Yep. And even, as a matter of fact, as you're talking about exports, I'll give you a factoid, which I didn't even believe. Louis Vuitton sells more handbags in China than through all of Europe. You know, I would have believed that if they included the fake ones.
Exactly. I was going to say.
This is the real stuff. So this is another example of a company. Basically, the growth is coming very largely from China.
What if you're willing to accept more risk? How can you really go for it?
Well, again, if you're willing to accept more risk, there are some funds that enable you to buy Chinese companies.
Are these mutual funds?
Well, they're not mutual funds because a mutual fund is open-ended. That is to say, you can put money in at the fund's net asset value. You can take money out at the fund's net asset value. These are closed-end funds. They raise some money, and then they say they're closed. And if you want to sell, you have to sell to somebody else, somebody who's willing to buy. And the person who's willing to buy might not be willing to pay the full net asset value. And one of the funds that I think is a very good one is something called the Templeton Dragon Fund. It would be another sensible way to do direct investments, though, again, I would emphasize that in order to keep risk down, the combination of some direct and some indirect is, in my judgment, the most sensible way to go.
For the average investor here in the U.S., how much of a portfolio would you recommend be dedicated to China-related investments? Is it possible to make a generalization?
I don't think you can make a generalization because it depends on one's age, one's income needs, and it depends upon one's tolerance for risk. I know people who literally get sick if something they've bought in their portfolio fluctuates too much. You know, it's the old story of J.P. Morgan was approached by a friend, and he said, Mr. Morgan, what should I do? My stocks are jumping around so much, I'm not able to sleep at night. And Mr. Morgan said, well, I would sell down to the sleeping point. So let me put it, let me try to answer your question then. A young individual who's got a tolerance for risk and isn't going to bother them, I think you could put 15% or even 20% of your portfolio into China. For those who don't have the capacity to take risk, for that kind of person, 5% might even be too much.
Burton Malkiel is the author, along with Patricia Taylor, of From Wall Street to the Great Wall. Sir, thank you so much for coming in. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
It has been a pleasure talking to you, Tess.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
We're back again with Getting Personal, and as always, I'm joined by Chris Farrell, our personal finance expert. And Chris, we've got an email here from Hernan, and he's in San Francisco. He heard the show earlier in the year, the New Year's show, actually, where I made a resolution that I'm going to open an IRA. And that's in addition to the 401k, the 403b I already have through the company. He heard that you can only contribute to a Roth IRA, not a traditional IRA, if you already have a 401k account. My friend, you must tell me as well. Is this true?
No, it is not true.
Okay.
The good news is you can have a 401k, 403b, and a traditional IRA or a Roth IRA. So there are two things to think about. First of all, with the traditional IRA, as you know, Tess, that's pre-tax dollars. And then when you withdraw during retirement, you pay taxes on it. With the Roth, after-tax dollars, so no tax break this year, but when you withdraw it from retirement, you don't pay any taxes. I tend to lean toward the Roth because you kind of pick up a little extra benefit. The second thing to consider is, in the wisdom of Congress, there are some income restrictions with the traditional IRA and slightly more generous income restrictions with the Roth IRA. So if you have a 401k, 403b, and you want to open up a traditional IRA or a Roth IRA, you know, just quickly check on those income restrictions to make sure that you qualify.
Okay, so Hernan, I am going to stick with my resolution and open an IRA, a Roth IRA, preferably. All right, we love talking about ways to fix your financial problems, but if we say something you don't understand, do let us know about it, and we will try to clarify, as we've just done. Visit our website. We're at marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link, or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And, you know, Chris, we usually get calls about fixing our personal finances, the listeners' personal finances.
Right.
But yeah, our next caller is much more worried about fixing the finances of others, a whole lot of others. James is with us from Maryland. Hi, James.
Hello, Tess. How are you?
We're good. How are you doing?
Excellent. Thank you.
So what do you do there?
Well, I'm currently working for the government, but more of a hobby slash passion of mine is I tutor corporate finance at St. Mary's College of Maryland.
Oh, terrific. What's the biggest question that they usually have for you?
I think the biggest question overall is, come graduate school, whether or not to consolidate their loans. You know, for someone with, you know, an art degree, it's incredibly overwhelming to even stare at numbers, let alone consider the difference between a credit card with no APR and cash advances and stuff like that. And I guess what I was trying to accomplish here was literally at a presentation no longer than an hour and a half, just impart the knowledge that these kids need to take on for the next God knows how many years of their life once they graduate from school.
Yeah. What do you do now for the kids?
Mostly it's just counseling my friends, mainly academics. I mean, do they need help with their micro or macro homework?
Mm.
And I, you know, it's funny because I even see econ majors who really don't understand how exactly a 401k works and stuff like this. I mean, not necessarily that's their job to, but it's just information they really should have going into the workforce.
Yeah, Chris, I think we have found over the years that personal finance is a whole different beast from finance and economics itself.
Oh, very much so.
Well, so any suggestions for James in terms of a kind of presentation that he could put together for the students?
Well, there's a couple of things. I've been looking at this website by the University of New Hampshire, and it's called Project Cash. And it's kind of nice. It has some really nice aspects to it. And there's also a jumpstart.org, which is geared toward a younger audience. But one of the things that it has is a very useful web links section. But if I were addressing your class or, you know, the students, I think there are a couple of points to really hit. And one is explaining a compounding of interest, explaining diversification, explaining exactly really how credit cards and student loans work, and the difference between good debt and bad debt.
And Chris, James mentioned that one of the biggest questions he always gets is about those consolidations of student loans. Is there a good place to get information about that?
You know, there's a number of good places. NellieMae.org, I tend to like their information, and that's quite good. And then, Tess, you last week or 2 weeks ago, you interviewed a gentleman at FinAid.org. And FinAid really has evolved into one of the better websites in terms of financial aid information and the student loan system. And just one other thing, James, you know, I think one of the things is you can, you know, you have the students are graduating with student loans. They've all been solicited with credit cards. As they graduate, you know, today, most young people with a college degree are going to go to a place at work that's going to have a 401k or a 403b and a retirement savings plan. And so these sort of like three aspects of our lives when we're young people that almost all of us are going to face compounding of interest and diversification and risk in some of those concepts.
And that's absolutely perfect. One quick tangent off of the credit card. I find creditcards.com is an excellent website for comparing benefits. Are there any other sites that you know that I could go to?
Bankrate.com.
Yeah, Tess is absolutely right. Bankrate is one of the better credit sites that's out there.
All right.
All right. Hey, so good luck with your presentations, and thanks for doing God's work.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, James.
Bye.
Well, unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take on this week's show. But Chris is now answering your personal finance questions online every single weekday. Whew, Chris, that's quite the job.
It is quite the job. But I have to tell you something, Tess.
Yeah.
The comments that I've been getting from people, they're really good. I really enjoy them a lot.
Wonderful. Well, do visit our website. We're at marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link there. And, of course, you can always give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Chris, thanks, as always, for the terrific advice.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. So we've just answered your burning financial questions and getting personal. Now it's time for your comments about the show. Many of you wrote in with feedback on last week's special program devoted to the middle class. After our Straight Story segment with Chris about how to fix what ails that portion of the population, I remarked, Chris Farrell for president. Well, he's got Peter Malin's vote. Peter writes from Williamstown, Massachusetts that, I only wish there was someone running as intelligent and caring as Chris and someone I could trust just as much. Hey, Chris, tell your New England relatives to stop writing us. As for the rest of our special program, John Weibel of Longmont, Colorado, suggests that Americans need to reconsider their assumptions of what it takes to attain middle-class status.
The educational industry in the U.S. has us convinced that we need a college degree to get ahead. Why is that the case? Why not go into a profession which does not require a college degree? Become a plumber and make $40,000 a year. Become an automotive technician and make $50,000 or $100,000.
We asked for your definitions of middle class. Claire Black Slotin of Davis, California writes, the middle class is not an income bracket, but instead a lifestyle, or at least it used to be. It means that a working person can afford food, shelter, transportation, medical care, education, and vacation for themselves and their children, and retirement for themselves. The middle class is an invented vehicle created by a society which has decided that wealth should be spread across the masses. Ryan Berlier of Lincoln, Nebraska, thought we failed to focus on personal responsibility in discussing the pressures faced by the middle class.
You seem to blame the squeeze on external factors beyond the average American's control, like the economy, rising health care costs, etc., when in reality, many people have just simply chosen to live lifestyles beyond their means. With the possible exception of unexpected medical bills, debt is a choice.
Well, speaking of living within your means, corporate America doesn't make it any easier to do so, what with all those fees they heap on us. In my recent interview with author Bob Sullivan about his new book, Gotcha Capitalism, we talked about hidden fees in almost everything we buy, including our investments.
The average 30-year-old who's investing a regular amount of money in a 401k account is losing about one-third of it to Wall Street in fees over time, $5 at a time.
But Martha Catt responded with a defense of at least some of those fees. She's a certified financial planner in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Money does not manage itself. Accounts must be established and maintained by human beings who need to be paid. The question the smart investor must ask is the service I receive worth the fee I pay? The old adage, you get what you pay for, still applies.
And finally, back in December, in a piece on those ubiquitous retail gift cards, I quoted the phrase about not looking a gift horse in the mouth, and I wondered out loud what the heck that means. Well, John McNamara of Hanover, New Hampshire, wrote to tell us that back in the day, when horses were the primary mode of transportation, if you were in the market for one, you'd first examine its mouth. The condition of its teeth would tell you how old it was. Now, if someone decided to give you a horse, you would neither, in John's parlance, diss the donor by examining the mouth, nor diss the horse, because the animal always had salvage value. We hope you find some salvage value in our show, and you're welcome to check out our teeth anytime. Tell us what you think of the program by going to marketplace.org and clicking on Contact. And finally, have you taken a look at mortgage interest rates lately? The housing boom may be over, but rates are at their lowest levels in almost 3 years. According to Bankrate.com, 30-year fixed mortgages hit 5.75% this week. Rafael Bostic directs the Lusk Center for Real Estate at the University of Southern California.
They're falling because the market is anticipating the Fed's drop in the interest rate. And as a result, they're moving and starting to cut rates across the board because they know that the cost of capital for them is going to be much lower.
And that means we could be headed for a surge in refinancing. Of course, that's assuming that banks will loan out the money, what with the credit crunch and all. Bostic says the low rates won't necessarily translate into easy credit.
It used to be fairly straightforward to get a refinance loan in this sort of attractive environment, but the credit crunch means that it will be much more difficult to do this for borrowers and homebuyers across the country.
So what kind of customer might be able to refinance with the lower rates? Well, first, you better have a great credit score.
The people who won't be able to take advantage of this are those that have spotty credit histories and credit records because underwriting has tightened considerably in the market.
And it's probably not worth refinancing if you have what's called a jumbo loan. That's any mortgage above $417,000. Those are much harder to come by these days because lenders can't sell them off to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And interest rates on jumbos haven't come down nearly as much as the so-called conforming loans. So refinancing wouldn't save you much money. And remember that many banks will require an appraisal for a refi. So if your home's value has dropped significantly, you may find yourself ineligible for a new mortgage. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, American women have more wealth and power than ever before. Really? But sometimes it doesn't pay to be daddy's little girl.
The only advice he ever gave me about money was, don't worry. There would always be a man to take care of me. My father did not believe that women should make or manage money.
Marketplace Money is produced by John Haas with Stephen Hoffman, Janae Darden, James Richter, Michelle Phillippe, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.